You are listening to Express Yourself on KDNK, and last but certainly not least on today's show, I am joined by Polly Litovsky, who in 2004 became the first woman to walk around the world. Her journey began on August 1st, 1999, walking from Vail to Aspen, and more than 20 years later, Polly is returning to the Roaring Fork Valley to present her talk, Little Steps, Big Feet, that's F-E-A-T, at the Basalt Library tomorrow at 5. How are you, Polly?
I am doing great. I'm so excited to actually be able to drive into Aspen tomorrow.
You're not going to walk this time.
Well, I remember when I did walk in, it was a rainy, but beautiful summer day. But yeah, hopefully it'll be nice tomorrow. I'll get there before the snow falls.
So 15 years after you completed this extraordinary feat, you walked across 22 countries, 4 continents. It took you 5 years. How many miles a day were you averaging?
It averaged about 16 miles a day, but that's really just because that's the average distance between towns. So if a town was 14 miles away or 22 miles away, I would make it to the next town. If it was just too far to walk in a day, I would just, you know, stop in between and either someone would come pick me up like a local and we'd mark my spot with, I had a big orange t-shirt for the longest time, or I would camp out.
Okay, great. So you did have some sort of security in situations where, yeah, if it was extra far between cities.
Yeah, not always, but it was always nice when it happened. What happened in a nutshell is that the Lions Clubs, which are a service organization based in every community around the world, like who knew, but they found me on the side of the road one day early in Australia. So that was about 7 months into my world walk. And they said the Lions Clubs have got to get involved with this and took me in and sort of took me out fundraising every night and passed me to the next town in their Lions Club, and they would take me to the pub and pass a hat around. And that started a chain of sort of a human chain around the world from village to village. And so sometimes the Lions Clubs would come out. Some member was on poly duty, and they would come out and pluck me off the road and take me home and water me and feed me and drop me off the next day. And that's kind of it in a nutshell. It didn't work as easy as I make that sound. Of course, it took a lot of nursing to strengthen that relationship, but the Lions Clubs have been, they were just a game changer in my life.
And that wasn't something that you accounted for in the beginning. You didn't set that up in advance.
You know, I don't even know that it could have happened that way.
Right.
If I'd had that vision magically, I don't think it could have happened. Right. It almost had to happen the way that it did, where this sort of grassroots from village to village, and you know, they created that strong link from village to village, and then there was social proof by the time it became an international sponsorship, mm-hmm. and the International Lions Club president got involved. There had to be some kind of social proof behind it, like, oh, she really is doing that, or you know, as opposed to sitting in my home in Vail, Colorado, saying, "Yeah, this is what I want to do. Could you think you could help me out?" I don't know that they would have agreed to that. So I'm blessed that it happened the way that it did. I really think it's the only way that it could have happened.
So I suppose the natural question would be, what made you decide to do this?
Or what possessed you? It really started when I was 12 years old, and I was growing up in Minneapolis, having a great childhood. And there was a day I saw the newspaper, the Minneapolis Star and Tribune, and I saw this picture of a guy walking down an empty road, pulling a buggy behind him. And the caption read, it was David Kunst walking down a highway in Colorado on his way home to Minnesota to become the first man to walk around the world. And that fascinated me. It still does. The fascination of the single step, the power in the single step. You keep taking a single step, and next thing you know, you look behind you and you've got some traction and some distance and empowerment with those single steps. So I thought, well, that's how I'm going to go see the world someday. Yeah, I'm going to walk. But even then, it was thinking way outside the box for a 12-year-old girl from Minnesota in 1974. So I sort of tucked that idea away in the back of my head and went on with my life. And 20-plus years later, living in Vail, a number of women in my world were being diagnosed with breast cancer. And it was then I decided that's what I'll do, that walk for it that I've always wanted to do, and I would dedicate it to the women of the world and be an advocate in various countries. And of course, some countries have never even heard of breast cancer, so it was different in every country. Funds were not raised in every country, simply wasn't viable. But where funds were raised, they stayed in that country. So that's sort of how it worked, and that gave me sort of strength and foundation and connections all over the world between the breast cancer groups and the Lions Clubs. My greatest fear was that I would be alone for so long, and what was that really going to do to my psyche? But in fact, that was rarely the story. In fact, the opposite, the polar opposite, really became true, and that was that there was this overwhelming crowds and attention, and then I wasn't prepared for that, so I had to become adapt to that very, very quickly, like on a dime. It's like, oh, I see what it's going to be like here. Uh-oh, better figure that out real fast.
And
so what happened.
How much money did you accomplish in raising for breast cancer awareness?
It was about $250,000, and I say that as a vagueness because I didn't take the money, so... And the organizations weren't great at telling me. So the best I could calculate in 8 different currencies around the world, well, 13 different breast cancer organizations in 8 currencies, it was about $250,000.
Wow. Well, that's such an accomplishment. And what a great purpose to be the driver for your walking. What route did you choose and why?
You know, when you start, especially in 1999, 98, when I was actually doing the planning, things change constantly, of course, as far as, you know, especially as an American, where can you get in? What visas can you get? So there's really one route that Westerners can go around the world. People go left, you know, east-west or west-east, but you run into other Westerners biking around the world. And, well, I don't think I ran into anyone else walking, but we'd run into bikers a lot. So it had to do with the red tape, and a lot of it had to do with the ease and support I could get. So it wasn't going to be easy all the way around, but I tried to stay in as many sort of English-speaking Western countries as I could. So I went west, went down through New Zealand and up through Australia. And then I hit the real foreign leg, and that was Singapore, Malaysia, into Thailand, across India, Turkey, and then up through Western Europe, and then back across the U.S. and Canada. So it was about 2 years of walking from, you know, where I didn't speak the languages. And I had this list of what words I needed to learn fast in every country. And it's not like you can learn these languages before you get there because you're so entrenched in previous language and learning that and trying to survive it and this kind of thing. So it was like immediate as you cross the border, done with that language, on to the next. So I had my list of 500 words and phrases I needed to know in every country. So,
wow.
Yeah, that was funny. I thought I was getting good at Thai, let's say, but no one could understand me. So they speak it like their L's and R's are completely switched. As we say an R, they pronounce L when they see an R. I was like, well, that's silly. But yeah, and their L's, they pronounce like R's. So
do you still have that list?
I must have that somewhere. I must have it. I haven't pulled it out recently. It has been 15 years since I've finished, and probably 17 years since I've actually used it. But I'm sure I have that list sitting somewhere, which is very funny. It's basically, you know, questions, which way to, how far to, but then you have to understand the answer if you're going to ask the question.
Right.
So numbers and directions were the first thing that I'd always learn.
Okay.
So, but I do remember jogging down a road in Thailand and just asking someone kind of in a shout, which way to, fill in the blank. And I remember his answer, go up here, take a right, and then a left. And it's like, oh, I could understand that. How interesting.
How exciting. What an amazing exercise, not only for your body, but your brain.
Thank you. Yes, that's what, you know, I'm glad you noticed that, because it's things like patience and, you know, the patience of the human spirit, because the best part of it and the worst part of it were the same thing, right? So sometimes it's very exciting to learn the new languages, and I found out that I really had this great acumen for learning languages, and I could get faster and faster at learning them as I was on the road. On the other hand, if you're tired and exhausted and grumpy and you just want to know where you're going and understand the answer. Mm-hmm. So the best and the worst things of it were often the same. So, you know, meeting the people, how fantastic. What a treat, considering that I thought I was going to be alone all the time. So it was the greatest thing about it. On the other hand, it got exhausting as well. So, you know, I had to drive that line, walk that line, as you say, between, you know, being patient and sticking up for yourself. Where's that line? Constantly walking it. Is this a time to stick up for myself? No, this is a time to be patient. Do you know what I mean? You're constantly mm-hmm. walking that line. But yeah. It was certainly learning every single day and hard work every single day. And exhilarating and exhausting at the same time.
Constantly adapting. And as somebody who's traveled internationally extensively, I understand that trying to fit in, trying not to draw attention to yourself often as you're making your way through a certain place. And so how was it settling back into quote-unquote normal life after this?
I settled in seamlessly. I was a bit nervous about it because people that had done similar things to this, whether they just go out and travel for a couple of years, bike around the world, bike across the country, it usually ended up being, say, 6-8 months or up to 2 years, and they would email me saying getting settled again was the toughest part of their whole journey, and they seemed to go through a depression when they finished. But there were two very different things that that made it different for me, and one was that I did not get settled in a town that I knew. I got settled in a big city. I didn't return to Vail. I finished in Vail, immediately moved to Denver. So it was a new city. I didn't know my way around, but it gave me an opportunity to ease in. It wasn't going into this community that I knew so well. Do you know what I mean? That, and everyone else had done that I had heard from. But the other difference is that mine was 5 years. The novelty was gone. Mm-hmm. The novelty was gone after about 3 years. I was like, okay, we can wrap this thing up, but I still had 2 years to go. So it was also that, and I think, I don't know if it's we as humans or we as women, we start to go through this nesting phase into our 40s, and I was 43 when I finished. Mm-hmm. So I think I was going through this nesting thing, couldn't wait to nest. And I remember when I finished, people asked, are you going to travel some more? And I thought, well, not right now, but ask me in 10 years. Well, now it's been 15, and I really have no want to,
you've got it out.
Travel. I've sort of entered a new chapter, which I'm loving, getting settled with the community and the friends around me and sitting at the coffee shop with a good buddy, you know, that kind of life. I'm really into that phase. But I don't think I could be as happy as I am in this phase if I hadn't gone out.
It's sort of its own.
That itch.
Its own form of travel, to stay in one place and to dig roots in and really meet people and stick with the transformations is its own journey.
Ask me in another 10 years. I may change my mind right now. It's like, oh, I just kind of want to go away, maybe for one night if there's a hotel involved. So
just real quick, we don't have a lot of time left, but a clarification. How did you get to Australia walking?
Oh, I walk on water.
That's amazing.
I'm just kidding. No, according to the Guinness Book of Records, at the time, it's different now, but to say that you'd walked around the world, you needed to start and finish in the same place. You needed to walk at least 4 continents, at least 14,000 miles, and you could fly between continents. I've never given 2 hoots about the Guinness Book of World Records, but I thought, well, everyone's asking me about it. So in the event that someday I give a hoot, I'd hate to then lose out on a technicality. So I did keep all the records. And it was just recently, just the last few years, I finally looked into it. And in fact, they don't do first ofs.
Okay.
They just do longest walk, and I don't have the longest walk record. So in order to get that, I'd have to get back on the road and do another 5,000 miles, which ain't going to happen. So it's just the first.
Well, there's plenty more to hear from Polly Litofsky, the first woman who walked around the world. And luckily for us, she will be at the Basalt Library tomorrow at 5 p.m. So I want to thank you, Polly. We got to get into the news here. Thank you for joining us on Express Yourself, and congratulations on what an extraordinary accomplishment.
Thank you for having me.